You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. Hello, everybody. I'm Allison Ritter from MLB.com, and I think that we need to start off by just talking about the Colorado Rockies and their third baseman, Nolan Arenado, who made possibly the catch and the play of the century. So everyone's going to be talking about that for a very long time, and we do get into that. The Diamondbacks are having a surprisingly decent start to the season and getting some contributions from everybody. The Giants are struggling, and I think everybody had a feeling that this might be a rough month for them, trying to muddle through without a couple of key players that they lost that went to other teams, and of course Hunter Pence, who is still waiting to come back from his injury. And the Dodgers are making their way through and very kind of an average team, but also with high expectations, and they seem to be putting it together a little bit. So very interesting things going on in the NL West as the month of April continues. We are recording this on Jackie Robinson Day, which is entirely appropriate that we're going to now talk to Dodgers reporter Ken Gernick. So, Ken, it's kind of cool because the Civil Rights game, which has been going on for 7, 8, 9 years now, but it's going to be, of course, people will be listening to this, it's already happened, but the Civil Rights game was at Dodger Stadium on Jackie Robinson Day, so I would imagine there's a lot of hustle and bustle around the ballpark for this day.
Yeah, it's fitting that it would be the Dodgers, huh, because that was Jackie Robinson's team, and it had quite an effect on changing the game of baseball and, changing our nation. So it's become really an annual holiday in baseball, and for real good reason.
So the Dodgers have had a couple of exciting games called the Cardiac Kids. They have now as many comeback wins as they did all season last year, two comeback wins in a row. So, you know, I'm talking to a lot of reporters, obviously, and it's very early in the season, but at the same time, I mean, that has to sort of – that's got to be fun for them and maybe give them a little bit of a boost as they continue to move forward to have these exciting last-minute wins.
Well, yeah, it kind of balances out some of the negatives that they weren't expecting, you know. So they've had some pitching issues, but their offense has been better than expected. It's deeper like they said it would be, as they intended it to be. And they're able to get contributions up and down. You know, they're not so reliant on a Matt Kemp or a Hanley Ramirez. You know, they make some double switches, and they get Andre Ethier, you know, with big hits, and Justin Turner with big hits, and Alex Guerrero off the bench. So they feel that they're, you know, and this is what they were telling us during the offseason, that they're more functional, they're more balanced, less reliant on one or two bats. When they go cold, they don't win. And for example, last night, Yasiel Puig wasn't even in lineup, and so they scored 6 runs. So they seem to be more capable of scoring runs at different times from different spots in the order. So they're pretty happy about that, and the fact that they are resilient, that they're able to come back and battle each at bat, and that's a big thing for a former batting champ like Don Mattingly.
I found it interesting. I don't think I've ever asked you about Alex Guerrero. I was reading what you had written about him a couple of days ago. I just found it very, very interesting. He's kind of not – he's been a guy that they paid a lot of money to, never really was able to find his way on this team. Good hitter, not so great fielder. He had some thing in his contract where he could veto any demotions to the minor league. So, you know – I guess that was kind of a regrettable signing for them, but he is sort of working his way into the mix this year and seems to have some value.
Well, he's an offensive player, and it seemed like when he showed up, he wasn't able to do the defensive things that they wanted from him, but they were basically asking him to do something that he had never done before. They tried to move him from shortstop to second base. He had never been on that side of the infield, and he didn't handle it well. He didn't make the adjustments, all the subtle defense adjustments. And I think there was some frustration, and it seemed like the front office and the staff basically gave up on him and figured he'd be a bust. But, you know, what really caught the scouts' eyes when they signed him was his bat. and he does have a bat. He can hit, and he's already shown it. So there really isn't a place for him to play without an injury. But there's a sure a purpose for a bat that can come off the bench and hit a two-run pinch homer. So you know, he fits. He fills maybe not the role that he wanted when he signed, and but it's still a role that's pretty important, and it gives the Dodgers again some offense off the bench, and not a slap hitter, you know. And Justin Turner's more of a line drive hitter, but this guy's got some pop, so it gives him another option.
Let's talk a little bit about Puig. He's had some a little injury issues, and he's been kept out a couple of days, and he may actually not make it back until Friday. I guess that's sort of to be determined. Are they concerned? Is this something that they think is just a little temporary thing? Is it just he just needs a little bit of rest?
You never know with Puig, but they aren't overly concerned. I guess whatever test that they ran, it didn't show that there was really a tear. They think it was just a cramp or just some tightness. And because there's an off day on Thursday, giving him Tuesday off, and I'm guessing that they're going to give him Wednesday off, and then that would be 3 days in a row, although he may talk his way into the lineup on Wednesday. But either way, we haven't heard that anybody there is concerned that it's a serious injury.
Brandon McCarthy's been interesting. Lots of strikeouts and giving up lots of home runs. So what do you think about him? Is he getting the job done? Is he getting lucky? I mean, they're winning some of his starts. What are you seeing just basically in his stuff and what he's been able to do?
Well, probably the best thing that he did the other night was he went seven innings, and their starters haven't been going deep enough. So that was good, but he did give up four home runs. At Dodger Stadium on an April night, that's not normal. You know, he's around the plate, obviously, if he's striking people out with no walks and giving up home runs. Striking out and no walks, that's really good. The home runs, they got to do something about, because he also gave up two in his first start. So it's a concern, you know, but you know, they gave him a lot of money. They really signed him to be a fourth starter, not a first starter. So while you'd love everybody you sign to be a 20-game winner, that's not what they're expecting. They need him to be a real good fourth starter. And from all signs, he's capable of doing that.
I thought it was interesting. I remember last week I was asking you about Ryan Webb, acquiring him from Baltimore, Webb who's been designated by the Orioles. And so then I get on the Dodgers website, and, well, the Dodgers have released him. So it appears that this was a sort of strategic move. They absorbed the rest of the money that they owe him, but what they got in return, I guess they just look at that as the cost of doing business. Is that the impression that you got from this? And do you think this is going to be sort of a trend that people are going to start doing this? If there's like competitive balance picks that are now in the mix for trades, I mean, do you think this is sort of moving toward that direction?
No, I don't think anybody would spend that kind of money for a draft pick other than the Dodgers, but they spend money on a lot of things that other people wouldn't copy. So it may be a trend for them, but I don't see it being a trend in the game, because that's a lot of money for a crapshoot, really. Plus, then you got to sign the guy. So that's just for the right to draft somebody number 74.
Yeah,
and then you got to give him $1 million or whatever it is, and then there's probably a 10% chance that he'll become a legitimate major leaguer. So I don't see, you know, the risk-reward. I think the Dodgers can afford it, so they don't see it much of a risk. But I think other teams, you know, most other teams have a budget, and this team apparently doesn't. So I think if you have a budget, you don't do this. It's a lot of money to spend for really a shot in the dark. But that is what they did, $2.75 million, and they released the guy who's a legitimate reliever, which is a situation that they're not that deep in. So it's kind of puzzling why they wouldn't at least try to hang on to him and see if he could help a bullpen that's been up and down already.
Yeah, no, when you hearing it in those terms, it doesn't make any sense at all, but maybe that'll become more clear as time goes on. Ken, thank you so much. And I am very excited to talk to my colleague Chris Hash, covers the Giants, because I'm such a fan of pregame ceremonies, and I covered pregame ceremonies a lot the first season, and so I'm kind of locked into that whole genre. And so I was reading all your coverage on the Giants, like, World Series celebration and the raising of the flag and a lot of things just totally, like, actually, I was actually laughing out loud. So I just want to ask you, Chris, about Madison Bumgarner, who rode on a mounted police horse, and his idea actually started during the parade last year when he wanted to ride a horse that was denied. Can you tell a little bit of the background on that?
Yeah, he wanted to, but the police chief, this is the post World Series celebration parade. The police chief of San Francisco, no less of people, said, "I don't think it'd be a good idea, you know, in case the horse got spooked or whatever." So, you know, that kind of got scotched right there. But that kind of remained in that idea, kind of that notion, kind of remained in the back of everybody's mind. And so when this opportunity rolled around, you know, they seized it. Madison didn't have to ride very far, so that worked out real well. And a good time was had by all, including Madison.
Yeah, so he rode the horse, and then he relayed the championship banner to, I guess, teammates who had, the guys who had been a part of all three championships?
For a large percent, most of them. I think with the exception of Buster Posey, who was warming up Chris Heston in the bullpen, and Pablo Sandoval, of course, who was gone, and Madison himself hung back. So, there were six other guys. So it was just a nice symbolic gesture.
I love you. Like, you're one of my favorite wordsmiths. I'm not just saying that because I have you on the phone here, but you called Bumgarner his horse ride an equestrian cameo. That was pretty funny. And so, like, whenever you play We Are the Champions by Queen, I mean, that just kind of there's no way to go wrong when you have that song playing. Like, it's just going to make everybody feel good, and even if it was a completely disastrous experience, which it obviously wasn't, just hearing that song, that had been pretty cool too.
Oh, yeah. The one thing that Giants do very well is ceremony, and, it was a it was just a neat day all around, except for one thing, and that was the final score.
Right. Yeah, I think it's pretty funny that the Giants people are now challenged to come up with new and innovative ways to celebrate their World Series championship. I mean, that is what cracks me up, is like they actually have to like sit and rack their brains to have something different than 2 years ago and 4 years ago. Anyway, we're all just jealous, you know, watching this from the outside. So I love. So I guess, you know, on a not-so-happy note, now we have to talk about what's actually going on with the team. Let's talk about Chris Heston for a second. I mean, he actually had a really good showing. So having been put into the rotation because of some deficiencies in, with some other people, I mean, he actually had a nice outing, a couple of outings, I guess.
I think they had kind of ignored him in spring training. I mean, he was a guy who could step into the starting rotation if there was an emergency. And I think given the relative health of a lot of the starters, they should have known that this might arise, and shouldn't have come to a surprise of anybody that he'd be called upon at some point this year. It just happened to be earlier than later. And, is he impressed with his, especially with his sinker. You know, it's been a real out pitch for him, the put away pitch. And, he'll go through some tests, of course, as the season goes on. But for now, he's been just a find for them.
And so he stays in the rotation. Kind of updates, like as far as things are right now, there's still a need for him, obviously. So he would continue to just keep taking his turns.
Right now, I don't know what. That's a good question. When Matt Cain comes off the disabled, what do they do? But I don't think they're worried about that right now. It's funny because lately the starting pitchers have all been pretty good, but the hitting has really, really suffered. And so maybe Chris Heston can swing it back. Who knows?
Yeah, and so that was my next question for you. This isn't shocking that the offense is having so many problems. I think that we sort of talked about it in spring training that the Giants were hoping that while Hunter Pence is out, that they can just kind of tread water, maybe stay around 500, try to piece things together. I mean, they really didn't know what was going to be, with Sandoval not a presence in the lineup anymore, obviously, and then when you take Pence out of the equation, it makes it even worse. So I guess we're kind of seeing what everybody had sort of thought might happen. How are the Giants, you know, kind of dealing with it? It's, of course, early, but yeah, I don't like to use the word panic this early, but is there some kind of tension maybe in the lineup at this point?
I think there is. I think they're already pressing. You know, last night they played without Buster Posey, which wasn't good. You know, that's their best hitter. And they've surely missed Pablo Sandoval and Michael Morse, who've gone, although they, you know, the new left fielder replacement for Morse, Lori Aoki, is the one of their few bright spots, I must say. Offensively, he just keeps on getting on base and keeps getting on base, but nobody's been driving him in. They've got, Bruce Bochy likes to talk about keeping the line moving, getting contributions from up and down the lineup, and that just hasn't happened.
Yeah, and it's hard, especially when you kind of give, you know, when Tim Hudson is actually, having some decent amount of luck. You don't really want to waste any of the, I talk about this rotation as if they're just like the walking wounded. I mean, you know, it's still a World Series defending team here, but at the same time, I mean, they don't want to waste any, like, really good outings by some of these guys that are, maybe there's some question marks around them as far as health or just consistency or whatever. That's got to be a little frustrating, too.
Yeah, some of this can be attributed, you say consistency, some of this can be attributed to early season, you know, getting the glitches out, and I think that's what they hope for, that's what they're hoping that this is the case. And once Hunter Pence comes back, they'll have to, and Casey McKee's been out with a bone bruise, you know, once they get everybody back in there, then maybe they can, you know, start to work on things.
And so Hunter is still on schedule for, like, early May-ish. Has that changed at all?
I'm sorry, is that Hunter you're talking about?
Yeah, early May. I think he was early May.
Yeah, and, you know him. He'll get back as soon as he can. Right. He'll probably have to rein him in. But he seems to be in good spirits, which is, you know, there's something to be said for that. And I think everybody will get a boost when he returns, you know, and, you know, mentally and, you know, psychologically, whatever.
Yeah, I'm guessing from knowing Hunter Pence a little bit that he is going completely out of his mind right now, not being able to play. So, Chris, thank you so much, and enjoy the game, and we will talk to you soon. I'm here with Corey Brock, who covers the most interesting team in baseball, or that's what some of us think. And Corey, let's talk a little bit about just sort of where we are. I mean, it's only been a week plus since the season started, so of course everything is a small sample size, as you did mention in your game coverage. But if there's anybody who's kind of off to a little bit of a slow start, I guess it would be the bullpen. Higher expectations and not such great results. So what's going on in that segment of the Padres?
Yeah, you're right, Allison. I feel like in every story I write, I need to include the small sample size disclaimer until, I don't know. I don't even know when you get rid of that. May 1st, maybe.
exactly.
Yeah, the bullpen's been dinged a little bit. Most of it's been kind of hung on Sean Kelly, who was one of their acquisitions in December from the Yankees. He's gotten up to a rough start, a couple rough outings there right out of the chute. So that's sort of skewed that overall bullpen ERA. And then a few other guys have been dinged for runs, but, you know, Craig Kimbrell, he's been, as advertised, he's been very good at the back end. He's secured every save situation he's had, you know, in this first 9 days of the season. He's been very good. So, you know, I think they feel like the production out at back end of the bullpen and in middle relief will be there and will be strong as they move a little bit more into the season. The starting pitching certainly has been exceptional, but yeah, it's been an interesting first 9 or so, 10 days, and we've seen a little bit of everything. But I think we've seen some of the things the fans were sort of excited about when they signed all these guys or traded for these guys. So I think it's setting up to be a pretty exciting season.
Yeah, taking 3 of 4 from the Giants, playing in front of packed houses. I mean, this has to make everybody around there feel pretty good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you and I discussed this, I think, at the end of spring training, that why it wasn't absolutely critical that they had to set the world on fire in the month of April. They have a history of being very bad that first month of the season and sort of getting buried. I think the key is, you know, you don't have to go out and kill everybody and crush everyone and roll up this beautiful record, but you just don't want to get, you don't want to get buried early, and you don't want to play poor early. And certainly they've sort of recaptured the fan base here with the off-season moves. Now they, you know, they filled that stadium for those first four games against the Giants, and, you know, they saw some pretty exciting games. Matt Kemp, Justin Upton, a few other guys played exceptionally well. So I think that can only help them, at least from a fan base perspective. And, you know, it keeps them hanging around in the standings early. You just don't want to get, you don't want to get thrown out of the race. You're not going to win the, you know, you're not going to earn a playoff spot in April. But, you know, I sort of think that you could lose one if you, if you're not too careful.
And they knocked out Madison Bumgarner pretty handily, right?
Yeah, and it's, boy, you talk about what they've faced so far, if you think about it. You got Kershaw on opening day, you got Greinke the next day, and you got a Madison Bumgarner who they hit around pretty well, and Jake Peavy, of course, started on Sunday. So that was four former Cy Young winners right out of the chute. So, but we knew that, you know, and that we talked about how the way April sets up with a lot of games against National League West teams, you know, you're going to run upon some good pitching and some big ballparks. And but for the most part, they kind of came out of that looking pretty good.
A couple of things that maybe stand out. Well, let's talk about Andrew Cashner. What stands out to you about him and his early start here?
Yeah, you know, he had that first start, Allison, in Los Angeles where gave up the three home runs to Adrian Gonzalez. And, you know, I don't care who's pitching, Bob Gibson, Nolan Ryan. You know, this is a guy, Adrian Gonzalez, who we certainly know a lot about in San Diego, was just extremely locked in. And, you know, a lot of fans were complaining, why are you pitching to him? And, I think that's a valid question. But, you know, each of those situations sort of dictated that you kind of had to go after the guy. You know, he came up with two outs and no one on the first time. And then the other two times he led off innings. So, you know, they got some pretty good hitters in that lineup. I really like Howie Kendrick, his addition. I think that he's going to really do well hitting behind Adrian. So, you know, you just can't give guys free passes, and you can't, you know, especially the Dodgers. So, you know, he was a little snake bit a little bit, just fastball location kind of got him. But he was much better this last time out, six innings, four unearned runs, nine strikeouts. So I think any concerns about Cashner are going to be a little unfounded as we move forward. But the key to him is just mixing his pitches and not being so heavily reliant on the fastball.
I think it's kind of funny, like, why are they pitching to him? I mean, it just sounds like something you say in August when you're, like, two games out. I don't know. Something about, like, April 13th. It sounds a little silly. Why are you pitching
to him? Yeah, exactly. But it's like, you know, and then Jed Jerko, the second baseman, you know, he's gotten off to a slow start, and he's been out of the lineup the last few days as they're getting Yan Solarte a chance to play a little bit more. But, you know, the fans are, you know, they really get quickly off the bandwagon of some of these guys, and then lo and behold, they come back and hit a few home runs and start playing well, and they're back on. So, you know, you really got to just pace yourselves from an expectations and a sort of emotional attachment, department in terms of what these teams do in these early days. There's just not a whole lot to go on. But I think by and large, if you look at the Padres from afar, and you look at how good that starting pitching's been, you look how good Upton and Kemp have been in the middle of the order, I think you see some things that are going to serve them really well as we move forward.
And I think it's kind of funny just that the catchers have really been doing so much to boost the offense. Like you said, there's a lot of things that you probably won't continue so much during the season, and that might be one of them. But it is nice to see what they've been hitting.
Yeah, and it's I look at some of these other teams. We saw the D-backs and, I look at the composition of, you know, some of their roster, especially their pitching and some of their position players. And they have some nice pieces, but you sort of notice a little more. I mean, maybe it's because the Padres, the composition of their roster is so much better than it's been in my previous 8 years that, you know, you sort of notice real guys a little more as opposed to teams that don't really have those guys. So, you know, I think Padre fans are going to really enjoy watching these guys play. And, you know, I'm getting a kick out of watching Kemp and Upton every night. I just think the dynamic of those guys, three and four in the lineup, is going to really do some big things.
I want to talk about the story that you wrote about this former Padres pitching prospect who has earned a lifetime contract. He had a terrible, tragic thing happen to him about, 10 years ago, where he had a heart attack in the middle of a game, I think when he was warming up. And I don't know that many people know that. I certainly didn't know this. Of course, this made me cry when I was reading it, but that the Padres basically have him as a contract for life, and so he gets health insurance for the rest of his life. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that and just how amazing the story is.
Yeah, and this is, I'm slightly ashamed to admit that this is kind of wasn't really on my radar either. Nothing's really changed with this situation. It's just kind of came to light again that, Matt LaChapa, who's a left-handed pitcher, a local kid, grew up on the Barona Indian Reservation. That's east of downtown San Diego for the out-of-town listeners. He was a draft pick, a second-round draft pick in 1993, and then he was warming up for a game in 1996 in Rancho Cucamonga. That's a high-A California league, and he had a heart attack. And, they were able to kind of resuscitate him. But, I think enough time passed, Allison, where, the lack of oxygen to his brain left him, with some damage, and he, there's a, he's really, right now, as you see him, and he was down at the field the other day and he, in great spirits. I mean, I think, he understands what's going on. He's sort of able to communicate a little bit, but, he's confined to a wheelchair for the most part. There's a lot of rigidness to his body and a lot of stiffness. Neat kid. And he was down there. A lot of players came over to say hello. But, the Padres have tendered him a basic minor league contract since, since he started playing, and just sort of continued that, even though he hasn't been an active player. And with that, of course, comes the, the basic insurance component, which has certainly helped out paying a lot of his medical bills. And that sort of transcended a lot of different ownership groups and team presidents that we've had here. And, as it turns out, there's only a couple people really in the organization that really have ties with Matt anymore. But, so he was down at the ballpark. I got a chance to talk to his dad and met with Priscilla Oppenheimer, who was the director of minor league operations at the time. And she's really the one responsible, Allison, for kind of keep getting this started. And, the Padres have, recognized that this is, it's something they didn't have to do, certainly, but, it's the right thing to do. And they've kept doing it. And, Matt comes down to a few games each year with his dad and his family. And they watched the game the other day, and I shook his hand. He's got a strong grip, and he was gripping the baseball in his left hand, much like he did, I imagine, when he was pitching. And it just kind of, it's one of those perspective moments, I guess. I know I'm rambling here, but, it's where you kind of realize that, oh man, all the little things going on in my life that maybe aren't great right now, just
right.
Maybe I should just deal with that and not complain, because this guy got dealt a pretty raw hand here, and but really making the most of it. And his dad and his family have a great perspective about them, and it was just kind of neat to see that this come back out and to kind of recognize the Padres, because they haven't sought any attention about this at all. This isn't anything that they send out press releases about. This is just something they've sort of done because it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, because I said 10 years, but it's actually it was 20 years ago. So it's a frightening concept that a 19-year-old kid would have a heart attack. Just so random and tragic.
Yeah, and there was one of the team's trainer, Jim Daniels. He was he gets a lot of credit for getting to Matt really quickly after the incident. Performing CPR before the paramedics could get there, and really saved his life. I think a lot of people have really assisted in the Matt LaChapa story to get it where it is today.
Yeah, good for the Padres. I mean, really, I think there's a lot of teams that probably do things like this that they don't tell anybody about, and they just sort of do it because it's the right thing to do, like you said, and it certainly. Yeah, it gives me another reason to root for the Padres. I really had no, I really don't have any feelings about really any teams. I'm sort of just like down the middle objective. But I was watching the game the other day, and they were playing the Giants, and I was really mad when the Padres lost that extra inning game. I thought, okay, well, I think I'm on the Padres bandwagon. So I guess you can count me as a pseudo fan.
Well, I think they're winning. Obviously they're winning back people locally here, Allison. A lot of people who have been maybe off put a little bit by, some bad finishes, haven't been to the playoffs since 06. You know, we've covered all this. This is a Chargers town. But, yeah, maybe, right. You know, they're winning back this fan base here and also maybe kind of opening some eyes for some people across the country that have heard all this buzz about A.J. Preller and what he's done and maybe are tuning in a little bit more to see, hey, but you know, Justin Upton's coming up. Let's tune over to see what he's doing. Craig Kimbrell's coming up. This is a James Shields start. I kind of like watching him. So that's sort of the value of having real guys.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point because there is always something that pops in your head like, oh, okay, it's the ninth inning. Oh, well, Kimbrell's probably going to come in. And there does seem to be somebody that's, like, very recognizable because they've been so much in the news. And that's half the battle, really, from a marketing standpoint where you're trying to get people to keep continuing to think about your team. Not that that's why A.J. Preller did any of this, but it's pretty genius, the fact that people are talking about the Padres everywhere.
Yeah, and then you could bet that team store, Allison, is pushing those, what are they called, those jerseys, I guess, right? The T-shirts that look like jerseys with the names on the
right.
Back. Hey, we got to get a Padres one that says footer on the back.
I dare you. I have now approached the best part of my day because we're going to talk to Thomas Harding about the Colorado Rockies. And Thomas, this is really funny because not long ago I was having dinner with a friend and colleague, and we were discussing Rob Manfred, the new commissioner, his new initiative to try to market the players better, make them more familiar to the fans. And we said, you know, there's a Gold Glover in Colorado, in Nolan Arenado, and you know, how do we make him more on the national stage? How can we let everyone know about this kid who's a really great player? Well, I think that Nolan has taken care of that for us because I think he just outed himself to the entire country with this ridiculous catch that he made recently. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what that was and what you were thinking when you were watching it?
Tuesday night against the Giants in the eighth inning, two guys on, nobody out, and Gregor Blanco hits a foul ball right by the bullpen. And, you know, in San Francisco, the bullpens are down the baseline. So along the left field line, Nolan Arenado runs about 100 feet, and as he's getting there, the ball's landing in his glove, he is hitting the roll of tarp that's in front of that's in front of the wall in front of the bullpen. Flips just about lands into the stands. I mean, he looks like a rag doll when he hits that thing. And he lands on top of the tarp, on top of the fence. Not only does he hold on to the ball, not only does he not break every bone in his body doing it, but he turns, gets up on his knees, and fires the ball to third base. Almost gets the runner who's tagging. That was unbelievable. I mean, I've seen catches against tarp. I've seen guys fall on top of and into the stands. But to dadgum near get two outs out of it, I had never seen that before. And I've been watching this game a long time. So that was certainly one that's worthy of the highlight reels. And it's funny, if I can kind of go off on a tangent here, but the Rockies have become one of those teams that's doing the shifting, the extreme shifts, putting three guys on one side or whatever based on scouting reports. And other than DJ LeMahieu for the first week or so of the season, I was thinking, I haven't seen those highlight-level plays. You know, maybe these guys have positioned themselves out of the Gold Glove because the ball hit to them instead of having to dive for it to make those plays. And specifically, I thought about Arenado. It's like, can I see a highlight-level play? Then that very night, he does something like that, and I'm like, okay, let's see someone top that this season.
It's really, I mean, I'm watching it right now as you're talking about it. I'm watching it on the Rockies website. And, I mean, I think about, like, Derek Jeter when he took the tumble into the – didn't he got kind of all bloodied up or he got a little bruised up? I mean, it's hard
yeah, his
to –
face,
it's hard to
that beautiful
face impact.
Got bruised. Right. It is hard. I mean, yeah, with Jeter, I'm sure that play will live forever because that face that was the face of baseball got a little bruised up there. And it was a great play because Jeter's running full go. He catches it before the warning track, and his momentum takes him into the stands. But to make that catch as you're being hit, almost like a football player over the middle, the way that Arenado did. And also, the ball was not the easiest thing to catch because it was coming almost directly over his head. To make that catch and hit the wall the way he did and still have the presence of mind to flip around and make that throw, that made it one of the top plays. And the other part of the play that's underrated is this happened in San Francisco at AT&T Park. And that is one of the most boisterous fan bases going. I mean, if you land in the stands after making a catch there, there's a chance you won't come back. The fans just won't give you back. And Arenado said that there was a woman there, and I could see her. She had on a glove, and she wanted to make the play. She didn't. But she actually kind of put up her glove and braced him a bit, and he ended up thanking her for doing that. I mean, that. So she'll live on the highlight films forever, too. And like I say, I expected them just to follow him up, and who knows what would have happened to him. You know, maybe they would have fed him to one of those giant seagulls to fly around the park. But instead, they gave him back, and they actually gave him a nice cheer for it.
I was going to ask you what their reaction was. So, I mean, the Giants fans are pretty knowledgeable fans, so I can see where they'd be pretty enthusiastic about a great play, even if it's not one of their own.
Well, they'd be enthusiastic about it, although most of the time, even if they are enthusiastic about it, I don't think that they give much credit to the opposition. So to get a cheer out of the Giants fans, especially the Rockies, because over the last couple of years, the Rockies actually have a winning record against the Giants. And the series is always intense. So for a Rockies player to do something like that, that's pretty good that the fans would acknowledge it.
So let's talk about these first-place Rockies, other than that amazing catch. So there's a few other things that are going on. So this has been a nice little start to the season. And why don't I just ask you, just kind of open the floor, what's been going well? What has stood out to you as some things that are going right for this team?
Well, the fact that they started the season winning their first five road games, which had never happened in club history, that's something that they should celebrate, no matter when that happens, when you win five in a row on the road. But the way that they are winning is, I think, pretty impressive. They came out of the gates really slugging in Milwaukee, hitting a whole lot of doubles. I think it was something like, 16 doubles in the first three games, which is a major league record. That was huge for them because of the reputation on the road. Granted, it's just out of spring training. They haven't had a long homestand where you kind of lose perspective of how balls travel. But still, them doing that on the road was good. To go to San Francisco and play well in that series, that's huge for this team simply because they have to do well within the division. It's a beginning of a long stretch of the division. So they are playing well offensively by having controlled at bats, by at times making the right play. I won't call it small ball. They're not quite a small ball team, but just very good at bats. The starting pitching has been, for the most part, competent. They do struggle with pitch counts and a couple of other things and some experience, but the bullpen has really pitched well. I mean, you know, what through the first eight games of the season, it was a sub-200 batting average against. That really means a lot to this team.
So on the pitching side, let's talk about that a little bit. With Eddie Butler, I find him to be a very interesting study at this point, just because everybody's sort of keeping their eye on him. And, you know, not wonderful results. You know, how is he getting through some of these starts? And does he have to evolve, like when the league kind of catches up to him? You know, what do you see happening with him?
Oh, yeah, he has to evolve. I mean, this guy, Eddie Butler, he's absolutely fascinating to watch because this is a guy who hasn't pitched at the AAA level, really. He made one or two or very few starts at AAA last year when he was injured, so never got used to the altitude. And he's just a couple of years out of the draft, so you're literally seeing him grow up out there on the field. What we're seeing is he's falling behind hitters, throwing a whole lot of pitches, walking way too many guys, walking guys to start an inning, and he's barely giving up any runs because he has such a heavy sinker. He's also able to change speeds, and that power changeup is a heavy one. Everybody's hitting the ball on the ground against him. I mean, you see talent out of this guy that you don't see a lot of, and that's got to be exciting for the Rockies because they don't go out and get the top free agent pitchers. A lot of those guys simply won't pitch in Colorado, so they have to draft them and develop them. And to see a guy that can basically stuff his way through a game and make a lot of mistakes but overcome them because he knows that he can get a double play or a ground ball, that's pretty good to watch. Now, what will happen as the season goes? If he continues to walk guys, put guys all over the bases, throw a lot of pitches, you are going to see one of those really ugly games, three innings, 10 runs, whatever it is. But with the talent that he has, if he does get people swinging the bat early and early in counts and early in games, you also could see him knife through on, 80 pitches to win a game. He reminds me a little bit of Aaron Cook, who was an all-star one year here and their leader the year that they went to the World Series and to the playoffs later on. I guess Francis was the leader of the year of the World Series, but Cook then. He reminds me a lot of a young Aaron Cook, where you saw some ugly outings, but you also saw some sequences to where, hey, this guy could be a very good pitcher in a difficult ballpark.
I was a little surprised that, I mean, given that they've gotten off to a pretty good start, that LaTroy Hawkins has already kind of lost the closing job. So I know this is his last year. He's retiring at the end of the season. He is 42 years old, and he blew two of three save chances. So normally that wouldn't be it wouldn't be that surprising. It happened so early. So what's going on with that?
Well, I think there's another factor that's working into this. If you look at what the Rockies did during the offseason, they weren't highly publicized moves, but they picked up guys like Jorge Rondon from the Cardinals and Jairo Diaz from the Angels, and also the guys that they've developed, Adam Ottavino, Brooks Brown. These are guys who strike people out, and the whole talk has been, we have to develop power arms in the bullpen, power arms late in games. You watch the World Series last year where the Giants, they just pass the ball around the bullpen, and different guys from different arm angles will come in and usually strike hitters out. You saw the Royals do that too, where it seems like a guy would come in throwing 96, and as a change of pace, they bring in a guy throwing 100. And that's what the Rockies are working towards. So when you have a guy like LaTroy Hawkins, who he still throws 95, but the issue with him is he likes to get contact, ground balls, not a big strikeout guy. When your team is leaning towards strikeout guys, I think that LaTroy Hawkins as a closer had a short shelf life this season. And the good part about it is LaTroy Hawkins is a team guy where if they felt like someone else could get that job done, then what he would do was he would take the job that they would give him and do it very well. And Tuesday night against the Giants, he comes in earlier in the game, gets a 1-2-3 inning at a time when the Giants need some momentum. So that's what went on here. And Adam Ottavino, he has developed into a very good pitcher with that slider of his. He's worked on a cutter that will help him against left-handed hitters. And he's one of those guys that fans latch on to. And it seems like if you've got a little something extra, that makes you a closer type. And he looks like he has that right now.
Yeah, he's a good guy, and he's one of the better teammates of anybody I've been around. So that's nice to hear that he'll just you know, kind of mesh into whatever they need him to be. And that could be very good for the team. So go Rockies. Thomas, thank you. And we'll talk to you next week
for our weekly chat with Steve Gilbert, who covers the Diamondbacks, who is speaking to us from San Diego. So he is well rested and in a very good mood. I want to kind of sift through the catching situation because I'm reading everything that you're writing, and I think I have this down. They started the season with three catchers, one being Jordan Pacheco, who is a utility man also and can play just about everywhere. Then Gerald Laird went down. So let's talk about how that whole thing got reconfigured.
Yeah, you know, Gerald Laird had some back spasms, and I think one of the concerns they had with him coming out of spring training was how would he handle a workload if he had to catch multiple days, because he is a veteran. He has had some injury issues in the past. And certainly they really wanted him to catch Archie Bradley's debut because he and Archie had built a really good relationship during spring training. But Gerald came down with some back spasms. They had to put him on a disabled list. And so that left them with two catchers. And it seems like that's kind of how they're going to be, at least for the next near term. But then they could look to add a third catcher, depending on how they get through this weekend with the bullpen, because they added an extra pitcher. So now they're carrying the extra pitcher. They probably don't need to do that next week when they have two off days, a rare week when they have a Monday and a Thursday off. But for at least right now, they're going with two catchers. But I always got the feeling, at least initially in spring training, that they viewed Pacheco as a third catcher, not really a backup catcher. But I guess he's done enough or did enough during the spring to kind of show them that he could handle the backup role, at least for right now.
And they like him. I mean, I think they seem to be a little bit pleasantly surprised, kind of putting it nicely, that he did kind of emerge as something more than maybe they thought that he was behind the plate.
Yes, and he's extremely valuable, as you mentioned, because now if he really is that good as a backup catcher, he add to the mix. He can play third, second, first, left field, right field. Those are pretty valuable people to have on a National League roster.
So moving on to let's talk about a little bit of pitching. Jeremy Hellickson. So he's kind of having a little bit of a rough start. We say that he has two games under his belt, but he seems to be a little frustrated because, who wants to talk about having made some progress and that you weren't quite as bad the second time as first? I mean, of course, no major league pitcher wants to be talking about that. So what is going on with him?
Yeah, he's not making the pitches when he needs to, it seems like. Not having quite the command that he's used to having. And they scored three early runs. The Padres scored three early runs on him Tuesday night, excuse me. And that was frustrating for him. He just couldn't seem to put that first inning behind him, and he put his team in a 3-0 hole. So even though, as Chip Hale said after the game, hey, it was a building process for him, he did improve. Hellickson wanted no part of that because the team had lost and he wasn't really thrilled with how he had pitched. So he did make some strides from his first outing, and certainly he pitched deeper into the game, which is something that, as we talked about last week, is something that the starting pitchers certainly needed to do. But it wasn't enough of a step forward for him to be happy after a loss.
So I don't want to talk about all doom and gloom here. I mean, the Diamondbacks, as we're speaking now, as we're recording this, a 500 team at 4-4. So just looking back at the first week of the season, and of course we realize that we are making big deals out of things that aren't a big deal and small deals out of things that maybe are a bigger deal later. Like, we all get that. But what anything like stand up to you, surprises after the first week, things, what went well for these guys?
I think just being at 500 and being above 500 for a day or two there is something for this team, because they got off to such a bad start last year. And they just, 8-23, whatever it was, they just buried themselves. And so this year their goal was to, if not get off to a roaring hot start, at least not bury themselves. And there's been some really good signs. I mean, the offense has shown signs that they were, hoping that they would be in terms of able to produce runs. The bullpen's been very solid. Archie Bradley had a great debut. So there's been a lot of positives to happen through the first week plus here for the Diamondbacks. It's been a start. Certainly everyone would like to be better, but it's certainly been a good start for them.
Does it mean something to them? Did it mean something when they won 2-3 against the Dodgers? I mean, you know how I feel about this rivalry. I find it a little... silly and childish, but they had to have been pretty happy to take the three from the Dodgers.
Yeah, taking two out of three against the Dodgers is who are expected to contend for the title in the NL West is no small thing, especially since the Dodgers, forgetting about the rivalry for a second, the Dodgers dominated them last year and struggled against them. And so for them to take two out of three certainly is something that helps build some confidence in the younger players. They hit around Clayton Kershaw pretty good.
Right.
And that's something, too, that when it happens kind of builds up the confidence of younger hitters. So, yeah, it was a good first homestand for them. They certainly left there feeling pretty good about themselves.
I would think that this was, especially when I look at, kind of the Rockies and the Diamondbacks as sort of being in similar situations where there's three other teams that are clearly going to get more attention, that have higher like projections, that people think that, the Giants and the Dodgers, the Padres are going to be in the mix. So you can sneak up on a few teams. I mean, especially like this time of year, I look at the Dodgers, like they have got some pretty big problems that are creeping up in their pitching situation. And so this is a time the Diamondbacks can kind of have a little bit of fun, I would think, and surprise some people.
Yeah, and I think Allison is, you know that the game is so mental that if you start off well and you start to build a little confidence and the younger players get confident, all of a sudden, you know, the team can do things that maybe weren't predicted for it. That's certainly what happened to the Diamondbacks in 2011. You know, they weren't expected to do anything. They started off okay, and then they hit a real hot spot, hot streak there in May. And suddenly they believed in themselves and they won a division. I'm not saying necessarily going to win a division this year. I'm just saying that when a team gets off to a good start and positive things start to happen, those things can kind of snowball in a positive direction.
How's Chappelle settling in? How's his impact been?
Say that again. I'm sorry, Allison.
How's Chappelle? How has he been settling in?
I think Chip's been settling in pretty well. I think that he certainly has a lot of energy and a lot of intensity, and I think he's kind of learned over the years how to spread that out over 162 games and not let it be bottled up for in terms
right.
of one night when they lose. And I think he's done a really nice job with this team in terms of communicating with the players. He's trying to juggle four what he calls starting outfielders and a middle infield situation that's still in flux. So he's had to really communicate. He's made a point of whether it's texting guys or telling guys the night before when they're going to be playing. That's been a big thing for him this year is communication. And so he's really tried to do a lot of that here in the first 10 days of the season.
Beautiful. Well, we'll keep our eye on you. So thanks, Steve. Enjoy San Diego. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Allison. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.